Before we get started, I am your host, Mr. Christopher. This is my illustrious co-host, Mr. Jeff Page. And we are, obviously, we're here to welcome the one, the only, Miss Jill Jones.
Hello. Hi, and thank you. What a great intro.
Oh my gosh. You look fantastic. I cannot believe it. It is such an honor to have you on the show. And man, we've been talking about this for a long time, haven't we, Jeff?
I know, right?
Yeah. I mean, ever since I picked up this little ditty right here, I was like, oh my gosh. Well, first off, I was like, who is this hot waitress on I said, I need to know who this waitress is on Purple Rain because I forgot who she is. And of course, I actually stayed for the credits. I knew most people. It's like, oh, Jill Jones, that's probably her. And then, of course, we got this beautiful album, But.
Oh, thank you for buying it.
Yeah, sure. And it's actually survived pretty well for,
I'll say.
40 years now.
Uh-oh, 40 years. Yikes.
It's getting really close. It's getting really close. But one of the exciting things is, obviously, we're going to talk a lot about your career. But on the same note, you have a brand new album coming out on April 16th. And I'm very, very excited to talk about that because there's been some tracks that have already been released. Unattainable Love, Red, and also Some of Us.
Yes.
So you got those three songs that have been put out there, and literally, you know, we're not going to fully talk about the album right this very second because there's so much else to talk about. But both Jeff Page and I were listening to these songs going, this, no joke, is like an 80s flashback. It's like it could have easily been on the Pretty in Pink or 16 Candles soundtrack. Yeah. It just has that vibe.
Oh my God. Yes. It is very, it was very, fitting for the times. I thought it was, I mean, definitely, but yeah, listening to it now has been kind of wild.
We could talk a little bit about it before we go into the full breadth of it, but I mean, is there really songs on there that you're just like, wow, this is just, this is really, really taking me back, or kind of taking you back to the headspace that you were in for really particular songs? Is there any songs that are on there that you're just like,
the whole thing, the whole project? When Neil Billinis called me to work on this, he was like, I have it and I want to put, you know, how would you feel about putting it out? I was like, okay. But I hadn't listened to it in ages, so when I heard it again, I was like, I don't know, you know. And it definitely has brought up things that, you know, to revisit. Not many of us really want to go back and revisit a lot of things in our life.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, it's fun, but at the same time, being young is, it just reminds you of all the things that you would have done differently because of looking at it now at, you know, 61 years old, like going, oh my God, I really wouldn't have taken it all that hard, you know, now. But yeah, just, yeah, it was kind of autobiographical, a lot of it, writing from your gut and, you know, just hoping someone will hear and understand and, you know, so much pressure. So, yeah, all of that. Yeah, I don't miss it.
Well, yeah, Mr. Christopher, you said it best when we were talking about it. He said it's like a time capsule. So, you know, had it been released then, it would just be gone. For it to come out now, it's kind of like refreshing, you know, like, wow. It's that flashback, like you said, it's bringing out that those thoughts of the past and who was I.
Yeah, and you have to go through this whole new acceptance of who you are and who you were, and that's tricky.
You know, I had a list of songs that I was expecting to see on this album, and shout out to the Phonogenics 101 website, that because I saw the interview that you did where they were kind of breaking down the tracks that were on this album, and there was a few that were on there that I was actually surprised weren't on there. The three are that I had written down were Ecstasy, Revolutionary, and Sweet Liberty, which right. I thought for sure would probably end up on those. Was there a particular reason why those were filtered out?
I think just finding something that was a little decent quality. Revolutionary ultimately got morphed into Flesh and Blood with Prince. So, and Chris Bruce, when I'd ask him if he had like the original, he wasn't around because he was in Australia touring with Michelle and DiGiocello. So it was a little, cause all this literally happened within like a couple of weeks. And it was like, hey, Chris. And he's like, great. That sounds good. You know, it's coming out, but he couldn't really find it. And then I was like, well, you know, just put out what you can. Sweet Liberty has had like three different generations of life. You know, I did it when I was with the Grand Royals. But I still love the original that I did with Chris. I'm not, you know, and that was not the version done in London. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I know we kind of just, we did pole vault over like questions to kind of go right into the London sessions, which is fine because it's just so compelling, especially listening to these particular tracks. How available are these? Is this album going to be in a physical form?
Oh, I don't know. I doubt it. I think it's just going to stay streaming. You know, I don't see us moving it into maybe, I mean, but only a few, you know, I'm so like, I don't even understand the music business anymore. So it's kind of like really just so weird to me.
You are not alone. You are not alone. And just so we're clear for people who are listening, if you want to check out Jill Jones on Spotify, I made it very, very simple for you. All you got to do is go to funkatopia.com/Jill and it will take you directly to her Spotify page and you can check out the brand new, stuff and everything. And it's going to be awesome. I cannot wait. Here's something interesting, and I don't know if this was just happenstance or I don't know. I am curious about it though. The album, the brand new album, The London Sessions, releases Tuesday, April 16th. And I'm not sure if I'm sure you've probably committed it to memory, but your contract with Prince ended on April 15th, 1993.
True.
Was that really specific? Was that the plan for the? I mean, obviously, it's already long gone and the contract is over, but
true. Is there
any consideration in that at all?
Neil had no idea. And when he told me, I didn't really mention it to him either because I thought it was a little spooky. I was like, ooh, wow. So maybe this is something that needs to be dealt with. Wow. All hands on the table. It went full circle, which was really interesting. Really.
Yeah, that was, I saw that and I was thinking to myself, I wonder if it was intentional for her to have that release date like
no.
that. Just because of the way it worked out.
Well,
not at all. And it was kind of mind blowing. You know, it was just really a very interesting turn of events.
Yeah.
Timing is everything, right?
Because I think when my contract expired, Prince was having issues, you know, with Steve Farnoli about Jughead. Was it about him or was it not? And they were suing each other or he was suing him and for defamation. So I remember 1993 was a very interesting year around tax time.
Yeah, I didn't think about that being the tax day. Yeah, you're
like,
right.
Who signs a contract around tax time? I was like, wow, I mean, what was I on? Like, I clearly didn't know. Okay, let's just make everything just be a big deal on tax day. Let's give yourself more stress.
So I am curious about that contract. I know we're going to keep this interview positive. I know there's feels in all courts, you know,
right.
But there are some curiosity points that I've always wondered about, you know, sure, and you know, obviously specifically about that contract, you know, because we got this CD, which is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you had all the releases of the singles and whatnot, but did that contract specify a specific number of albums that you were going to be contracted to release via Paisley Park during that period of time?
Seven. Mm-hmm.
So how were you able to really kind of walk away from it?
I wasn't able to walk away. I had to ride the whole thing and wait 7 years. Basically, it was he had every right to pick up the option. And, you know, they give you money, and that's supposed to, you know, tide you over while you're recording your records, but then you're accruing debt because you're in the recording sessions and you're doing all this other stuff. Yeah, no, you can't. I mean, there's just, when I went to write with other people, which made sense because his company was growing, he wanted to do everything. So it became difficult to find a leg to stand on, you know?
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. Especially at the age you were back then, it was kind of
Oh, my God. I mean, and when my contract expired, I was pregnant with my daughter. I was literally sitting in my house, like, you know, watching, I don't think OJ had killed What's-Her-Face yet, or I don't know if that was on the news, but I do know that I was literally sitting at my house pregnant in April and had my daughter in July. Mm-hmm. That's Zuzu.
Yeah, I try to be prepared with a little bit of this stuff.
Now, yes, you are. I love it.
So this is, you know, what I find intriguing about her, obviously she is obviously the spitting image of her mama, but what is she doing now with, I know she's in music, but I don't know that I've heard anything specific.
She was on Fiction Records. She too got off of her deal, which was fine, but you know, she likes privacy, super, super private person. After seeing, you know, her father was a model, very popular model back in the day. And I don't know if Zuzu really likes all the entertainment people that much. You know, she went and got the deal on her own at Fiction. She went to London. She just, you know, had these songs. That rapper XX, the one who got killed in a he reached out to her on SoundCloud.
Yeah.
And he liked this song that she had called You. It was acoustic, and he sent her text like of encouragement, whatever. Anyway, that was interesting. She had this whole life that I really didn't know online. Went and got her deal, put out her singles. And then they didn't, you know, give her the full deal, you know, finish the album. She took her stuff, she left, and she's working on things. But I don't know if that, after seeing everything and everybody in this kind of game, I don't know how much she wants to just be out there the way it exists now with the social media. And she's just, you know, I don't know. Not everybody is an extrovert, you know.
Right.
She's a real artist, like a real artist that wants to play, does her music, but nose to the ground, is not about trying to like, look at me, 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 you know, hey, look at me again, you know, it's too much. Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that is how it is right now. It's with if you want attention and growth, you've got to play the social media game. And that's really tough.
It's really awful because it's a whole generation of people who really don't have any good music.
Right. True. It's all just
because you can't have good music with extroverts. I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, even Michael Jackson, the reason he wasn't writing is, well, he wrote, but you know, it's kind of like the introverts were writing the songs, giving him the hits. The introverts make the music. They make the world. They actually, you know, reveal a lot more today. I don't know, but we'll see what she decides to come up with. It's kind of crazy. I went to a friend's fashion show the other day, and I was shocked to see how fashion shows have changed. It's like advertising going on in the middle of it. And, you know, it was just the most dogs came out on the runway. I was just like, what the actual hell is going on? I was looking for Chris Tucker to come in from the Fifth Element in the middle of all of it.
With the microphone.
Yes. Every event has turned into like you're at the Fifth Element and nothing is chill anymore. It's just like this desperation on everybody's face and their energy. It's like New Year's Eve all the time, it seems. Everybody's got the last minute to get their shit together and be somewhere to make it happen. It's crazy. Right.
Yeah. It's, anyway. yeah, it's Yeah, we I think we've said this quite a bit. It's like most of the music that comes out today, it's pretty much disposable. I mean, anything that you even hear on the radio right now, a year down the road, it's not like it's just not the same anymore. It's just it's like, okay, can we spit it out quick enough? I mean, even think about how, you know, artists that are pretty fairly huge, like Dua Lipa, and even right. Taylor Swift stuff, it's just like what was on the radio from them, you know, a year or two ago.
Right.
You know, just doesn't stand the test of time. It's just like keeps getting.
And everybody's bouncing around like a yo-yo. I think I've got like, I was driving in the airport the other day and I was like, when did everybody become a bloody cowboy? Everybody's driving a truck, Silverado. it was like, I couldn't get in. I was like, good God, you know, if tomorrow, I guess if Beyonce wanted to do like be an Oompa Loompa, everybody would be Oompa Loompa-ing it. Looping. They would do it. It's too trendy. It's so weird. It's like everything is Halloweenish and, you know, but yeah, literally every guy right now in America suddenly had to get a pickup truck. Yeah. And I like country music. I always have, but I'm just like, come on, you guys aren't even driving it properly. And you know, in California, you don't need a drive. You can go any speed you want out here in Los Angeles. Nobody cares. You can drive on the sidewalk. You can do anything you want. Police, they sit it out. They've been sitting it out. So if you like coming fast, Ben, do it.
Yeah, I imagine you got to go above and beyond to really get pulled over over there.
It's my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you have to be like, you know, I've got cameras on me. They're going to be chasing us in a car chase. And then the police are like, okay, let's go.
Hey, Fort Bronco.
Yeah, I think what I miss kind of with music is just this, self-awareness of an era of time. I think Prince was great about that. I think writers from that day were able to be, you know, kind of give you a view of the era. It's really kind of weird. I'm really surprised they haven't, like, you know, that the trans movement hasn't picked up, you know, I Would Die For You song. I think that would be great. Like, just, I'm not a woman, I'm not a man. I mean, these are conversations to be had. There were things that
I would imagine that would be have something to do with either, I mean, obviously the powers that be. I don't know. I never know how much power lies in the hands of the estate and how much power lays in the hands of what's the name of the company? Whatever.
Primary wave.
Yeah. Because they obviously are really trying to hardcore protect the legacy of Prince, but if they really understood the legacy of Prince, they also would understand how open and how accepting he was of everyone right. and everything.
True.
But they're not looking at it like that. They're looking at it from a political angle and trying to say, we don't want to step on anybody's toes right now. It's okay for Target.
right.
But not that. So I get it. Understand it from the corporate side of things, but again, it's not truly at the heart of what Prince was doing. So
yeah, no, I don't think they understand it one bit.
Yeah. I want to learn about Jill, so I mm-hmm. want you to tell me about this photo here.
There it is.
Oh my God. I've seen this and I posted this at one point because someone had sent it to me. We are up, my mom, my stepfather Fuller, Tina's in the background.
Tina Marie, yep.
And me in the front. I don't know who's beside me. I can't really see. It's one of the Gordy kids or relatives. Basically, we're at Barry's house, and that's in the garden. I'm trying to remember if we were at Terry and Desiree's wedding, and then we came back to the house for a reception, and then everything was outside. I can't remember, but yeah, mm-hmm. family event.
So it seems like wedding attire for sure, but you know, well, obviously Tina caught my eye. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's
she sang Ave Maria at the wedding. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Of course.
That's of course. Why not? It's just all it takes is a nod from Barry and you're there. It's like, okay, it's where, where do I set up? Yeah. So I think what's interesting about this, I love the background of everything between, you know, that transpired between you and Tina. I know there was a lot of different things that, that happened with your relationship and your actual career. Did your career start with Tina Marie as far as being the background vocalist, or was there somebody, something else before her?
I mean, you know, it technically, I would say, started there. She would always be recording. She'd pull me in to do backing vocals. A lot of things, you know, Tina would pick me up from school sometimes, and then I would just sort of tag along with her to whatever her next destination was. And if it was singing and I was there, but that's not entirely true. Like my stepsister, Iris Gordy, was before I even met Tina, my very first inkling of it was Tata Vega. My stepsister managed her, and she was a Motown artist. Tata's since gone on to do like gospel. She's a phenomenal singer. And she and Tina were kind of rivals on Motown. They were really very similar, each one pushing, you know, for the same kind of thing. But then Tina, of course, aligned with Rick, and that changed everything. And Tata went another direction. But I remember going to the studio because I was living at my stepsister's house because I was going to a school in Beverly Hills, and we lived in the hills of Hollywood, so I couldn't. So I stayed at Iris's house, and the engineer was Umberto Gatica, who went on and worked with Celine Dion and Barbara Streisand and all that. He's a phenomenal engineer. He's like a legend, Ecuadorian. And I had the biggest crush on Umberto when I was a little girl. I was like 12, and I had the biggest crush. And I would just go to the studio and just hang out, you know. And then I think I don't know, I didn't sing on anything there, but I did sing on something with Mary Wilson.
Really?
At some point, there was a song that we all were together and I did backing vocals with Mary Wilson.
Wow.
So that's... then Tina moved in our house and mom and was managing her, and she lived there and she was like my sister. Then it just sort of escalated to where, you know, we were rehearsing in the garage of the house. And well, Tina had gotten this thing where she was going to work with Benny Medina and my cousin Carrie Gordy, and they had a band called Kryptonite. And so for some wacky reasons, when Tina's band left Motown, or they dropped them, but they kept Tina, no one really knew what to do with her at one point. Mm-hmm. So they put her in that band with Benny. And it was kind of like a very political situation of like, are you going to turn down the chairman's son who is in this band with Benny Medina? What are you going to do? She did it. And she was not a happy camper because she wanted to be a solo artist. And I used to go to those rehearsals with her and sit through the evening after I came off of school. I would go, or on the weekends, and I would just hear her upset about it and sit there when she was like, you know, talking to Mickey Boyce, Mickey Hearn, her best friend. So, yeah, we drive all the way from like Lancashire all the way down to like the streets of like Venice, California, which in those days, you know, California and Rose or those areas were a lot tougher than they are now. It's not the same Venice, California at all.
Yeah. Every time I look into some of the background of Barry Gordy and just some of the connections and everything that he has, I always uncover something else. I'm like, I didn't know he was like Redfoo. I did not know that from LMFAO was
his son.
His son. I was like, I didn't know.
Stefan.
And because I think the only person I really probably even knew, you know, family wise, that was, you know, entertainer, obviously, was Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like, wow, okay. So, but you were like pretty much mixing and mingling with that family, and I imagine that there is definitely, I'm surprised you didn't end up on like way more of those artist albums, or did you? And just.
No, I didn't. And I think in the spirit of how the family operated. Yeah, I think everyone was sort of a little autonomous at times and doing their own thing, but I didn't really ask anybody for any help, even when I was in the real, you know, shitter with my situation, with my own label and what was happening and not happening. Barry had called and had asked, you know, things, but I was like, I was almost ashamed to say that I didn't listen from the get-go, because Barry had called me at one time during the whole process, especially when Denise was leaving, and he was willing to talk to Prince about, he goes, I don't, and Prince never called him that I know of. And he said that Prince wasn't pacing his career. He didn't pace himself. And I said, well, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, he thinks he knows everything. So it's like, I mean, that was, you know, a man who's like my uncle, mentor. Barry was, I remember one time Barry took me to the Playboy Mansion when I was 15, because I started showing out a little bit. I started skipping school and, you know, doing things and thinking I was too grown. And he took me on this like lunch, and I had lunch with like Hugh Hefner and,
what?
And Jim Brown was there.
God. All right.
Women. But what was so weird is that in the lunch, these men were telling me what kind of woman not to be, which was everyone there. And I remembered saying, but you guys are like with all of them. And they were like, yeah, but that's a different thing.
Right. Wow.
They tell you from a professional angle or from just a
parental angle.
Life and parental. Yeah.
If you're 15, I would imagine at 15, they're
go
probably
back to school, get your education. Basically, yeah. Stay out of show business. The part, if you want to be in it, makes more sense to be behind the scenes. All of that. I mean, it was so interesting when I look at it now. They weren't wrong. That's where they really weren't wrong. There's so much that when you're in front of the camera and when you're, I don't think I lacked in my family upbringing that I needed that much attention. As messed up as my upbringing kind of was, I just don't feel like I needed attention like that either. As I said with my daughter, I just feel like if you're kind of raised and you're very secure, you don't need that. You don't need it. You do your work, you go on, and that's how it goes.
Right.
One of the information or the suggestions that they gave you would have been different if you were like 18 to 21. I think when there's a 15-year-old girl sitting there in Playboy Mansion, you're like, I know what you see, but let's.
And the girls were lovely. The girls who came and were there, they were so nice. But even, you know, it was a very interesting situation how when you're one of their own, when you're inside the circle, the advice you get is going to be different than somebody who walks into the circle and they're exactly. from the outside.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. So
stepping
outside of it was kind of like, why is she doing, what is she doing?
Right.
You know, because my, you know, stepsister Iris is like very executive, very woman power. My mom, all of these women were, you know, businesswomen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. Because especially
you couldn't want anybody more like as to look up to someone like a Suzanne DePass was. That woman was just, you go, wow, she's a real go-getter. Back in her day, it was like there weren't many women like Suzanne DePass.
Well, and speaking of, you know, women empowerment, going back to Tina Marie, mm-hmm. I've heard stories of you saying that Tina Marie's house was like, it was full of powerful women, like on a regular basis. That was just like, if you wanted any type of inspiration or any type of, you know,
it was like going and visiting Wonder Woman's house.
Right.
She had a golden lair and they go, tell the truth now.
You know,
real. And then they, then she had a daughter, and then there were children, and very girl, very female, strong energy when it all comes together and it's right. And it's not like a bitch fest. Yeah, it was, it just is totally phenomenal.
It's wild when you think hindsight and you think, wow, I was being watched, protected, and advised. Now, whether you picked it up at the time or not, but again, right, looking back, it's just like, wow, you know, like something was really trying to make sure that I moved correctly. Even if I didn't, something was still watching me, because, hey, you're, you know, here you are now still moving and doing things, trying to create. Yeah. So
it's true. It's like, it's really, you know, it's to see a lot of, to see them leave was very difficult for me. Like, you know, Tina particularly, because it was just, we had just really reconnected on a level where she didn't see me just as a child. I had my own child and it was very different. And I could be really honest with her about my trek through life, you know, without hiding things or, you know, and the same for her. So yeah, that this business does stuff to people, but it didn't do damage to Tina as far as like, cause I, when I went to her house, like in 2010, before she passed away, I was in a bad way. I was like, I had just gone through a major breakup with somebody I'd been living with for like close to 10 years. So that's always a really big shift. And I was incredibly depressed. Like, what am I going to do? And then I saw her and it all made sense again. Everything made sense. The world seemed right again.
And when you're talking about the house, it was also interesting that it was like one of those things where people were in and out. And I heard you mention that Lenny Kravitz was like regularly in there also. I mean, what was the story there as far as, you know, well, what other names were there, but also more curiously?
I don't know. Tina just had a way of like, she really was that, you know, Mother Earth woman on It Must Be Magic album with the children around. Everybody was kind of like her child. And Lenny, I think, came when he was just going through a real shift in his life, you know, with being famous and then what was happening with him. And I think he just sort of stayed there for a while and got himself together and just, you know, because it really, it was a very healing house. It just had that capacity. I know that she had told me about, I don't think Rick stayed there at all, like in that capacity, but because, you know, she was also raising her child and then Penny, her manager, Rick's sister, her daughter was there as well. So, you know, it was a very safe space for young people, young children. So there was that too. It was like Mother Earth. Yeah.
All right. So here's something interesting. You know, so you're doing background vocals for Tina Marie, doing, you know, touring, and she's supporting this guy. And I have to understand a little bit about the first album that I really got into from him was this album, was Dirty Mind. Dirty Controversy Mind. Obviously kind of like kicked the door open wide for me. True. Dirty Mind was just kind of like, I don't know how I feel about this. I like it, but it's like, I wasn't absorbed in as much in this as I was in Controversy, but I can't imagine what you specifically are thinking about him at this period in time. When you see him, that first show that you guys opened for Prince, and you see him coming on the stage, you know, dressed and doing the shows that he's doing, what was your first thought, your first impression seeing him?
I think he unnerved me a little bit. I think that, you know, it's like sometimes I think now when I look back, like maybe my psyche or my spirit realized I was meeting something that was going to change my life, you know? And it's so funny. I had gone to a psychic fair a few weeks before, here in LA, and it had said I was going to meet a guy with a black car who was going to change my life. But I didn't put it together with him at this time. So when I met Prince, I think I was a little bit obnoxious, probably because he unnerved me so much. I didn't really watch his shows at the beginning. I was always taking pot shots at him. And he took pot shots at me too. So I think it was nerves. I think it was nerves. I think it's somebody that it's a big feeling and you don't know what to do with it when you meet that person. And I think we both had it.
Right.
Quick question. You can refuse to answer if you want to. I don't need details. But did you guys ever have a real romantic relationship?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I always see these comments of people like, Prince and Jill were never together. She was just his protege. I was like, no.
Actually, the pictures that I just put up, that came out the other day, somebody had said, oh my God, here's, you know, Rocky Schenk. You did these pictures with Rocky, who had done a lot of work back in the 80s and from like REM and B-52's area. From Georgia, funny enough, I think he was from Athens. I think Rocky did these pictures, and in the picture I had told Jill Monroe, I said, oh my God, it's me and rings. You know, I lost my mom's ring like a few weeks back. And funny enough, ever since losing that ring, what I've gotten back are old pictures, old things, old reminders. It's so weird. And typically in Mercury in retrograde, the ring that Prince gave me is in the picture with my hand. So that's the only known photograph of the rings of that piece of jewelry. Wow. So it was really interesting to see that picture. And I went, wow, there it is. Yeah. And that was that. So, yeah, we were romantic, which I think is what complicated everything, you know, muddied the waters, basically. But who wasn't he? Prince, I don't think, had platonic relationships with people unless, you know, the girl was a lesbian, right?
I mean, yeah, I was going to say,
I'm not so sure. I was like, right.
I know there wasn't really much there going Wendy and Lisa, but even with Wendy more so, I was like, I believe that Lisa probably could have had a relationship with him, but it was like something like probably in the earlier, like yes. Right around that time period could have been, yeah. Don't know. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what we were talking about.
Yeah.
we'll kind of migrate away from that. But I saw something that really kind of caught my. I did not know this. I knew that when Vanity, so you go over and you start working for him, doing background vocals on the 1999 tour. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I did not know, and that was the first concert that I ever had seen, was the Triple Threat tour at the mm-hmm. Fox Theater in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
And one of the things that I did not know, I knew that Vanity Six was out there and at the time was having to double as the band behind
long night for them.
But I did not, but I heard that you were also behind the curtain singing background vocals.
I was.
So, I didn't know.
You know, Susan didn't do harmony. She did her part. And I was just the, you know, sort of beefed up the sound out there because it was just three of them. And, you know, yeah, I beefed it up. Yeah. I was standing right beside me in Jimmy Jam. I had my little microphone and he was on his keyboard. Yeah, it was funny.
That period of time, the songs that you created, not just what you did live and the extra, you're kind of like the Michael McDonald of the Purple Circle world. It's when you,
and I love Michael McDonald so much.
When you hear Michael McDonald singing in the background, you know it's Michael McDonald. You're like, yeah, that's Michael McDonald.
I don't know what he's saying.
I know.
What are you saying? Awesome. I love it.
But you're like the same thing. It's like, oh my gosh, that's Jill back there. And, you know, you notice it on like 1999.
True.
And I'm just like, And I didn't realize that, because a lot of times you weren't even credited for a lot of those things, and which was, he was notorious for, because I also know that, I didn't know this until recently. I don't think until this century that Jesse Johnson was also singing background vocals on 1999, yeah, doing the party and what all the other, the ad lib, yeah, stuff. I did not know that. So when 1999 came out and I saw,
yeah, I don't know why Jesse showed up at the house that day. I'm trying to remember, because we were downstairs in the little studio with the sliding glass door.
Hmm. Wow. So when I saw that there were, you know, the background credit had JJ, I thought
it was him. Right.
And then I realized it was you, or maybe it was Prince being slick and going, I can kind of give credits to both and we'll just both think that.
Right.
Yeah. It's probably that. Right. You know? Yeah. Knowing that's
who knows.
I know.
But there were so many things. I am curious though, because of all the work you did, I mean, obviously people know, people who are really hardcore about finding everything that he's ever done. I have so much stuff from you that is unreleased, that I've gotten from a variety of different places.
Wow.
You know, Boom Boom, obviously everybody's probably, you know, heard that one, but is there a specific song that you probably performed with him that is sitting in the vault that you're like, God bless, I wish they would release that song, because that one's like, that was like, that song was a shit or whatever.
I really have always been wondering where Moral Majority went. And everybody seems to think that they found it in a box. I think they recorded over it. It was a really good song. It was for Vanity Six before they left. And it was a great kind of political song, because we'd all kind of gotten charged from Tipper Gore that we were sluts, and, you know, we should go to hell and burn forever, which is so wild that, you know, I would even be a Democrat at this point, which I'm not, I'm an independent now, but yeah, that was, so Moral Majority was about that group of women who were a bunch of other bored housewives. And they're the reason that there's stickers and stuff, you know, these women have to be busy doing something. Right. And so the song was just a great song. I just really feel like it hasn't been revealed, because I don't think it's there, because it's just not there.
That's a shame. I mean, I think of all the songs that could have possibly been.
Euphoria Highway was longer. There was a whole thing about Bobby and Vicky. It was about their love affair, how they met. They had the greatest love, just one look, and I knew there wouldn't be another for either one of them. The couple most likely to, it should have been me and you, my first love, my last love, should have been, it should have been you. That was the chorus.
Wow. Yeah, I think, I can't remember if I did hear a piece of that song.
But I sang the, when it was ripe, and then of course he sang it too, but I think my version was better.
Well, I think, you know, the perception of a lot of the groups that Prince put together in that era of time, and even specifically talking about Vanity Six, who was previously called the Hookers, he really wanted to try to make sure that, you know, he really wanted to up the ante on the sexual innuendos and everything. Right. That's not even an innuendo. That's just like, the Hookers, here we are. And I love the story about how he tried to get Vanity to change her stage name to Vagina. And she was like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, she like put her foot down. No. Right. I mean, yeah. I think he would come to LA a lot, and there was K-Rock, you know, KROQ was always the station. And, you know, you would hear things like Lena Lovitch and those kind of people. And he was right. Kind of influenced with these names. But you could, you know, I might like you better if we slept together. Who sang that one? Whatever their name was. But he was pushing the envelope for the Hookers, because it kind of felt like it could have gone over at that time. That's right. The era we were all in.
Right. Yeah.
It didn't seem like, right. You know, we were pretty an open crew generation. We're like, yeah, okay. Oh, they're the Hookers. They're really good.
Very cool guys.
You say that, but I can't really think of any other artist that was pushing the boundaries like he was back in that time. I mean, I know Rick James was kind of doing it slyly.
That's true. Yeah.
but nobody was coming out like he was, and it was just
No, Head was a real head turner. It was like, what are you listening to? You know,
and Sister. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's happening? It was like, oh, she's just talking about, you know, the cultural thing, Sister. And it was just like, and then he specifically, then he flat out uses the I word, and you're like, oh, okay.
Right. Not,
I mean, it's so weird because when you're working, when you would be working on these songs or working on things, you would find yourself listening to things later. You're not listening for those things, like, you know, the sensational lyrics. You're like, oh, that snare. Yeah, I hear that. Oh, the bass line. Yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, was, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah, nobody was coming that hard for him.
Was there any, well, Tipper was.
But, she did. Right. Yeah, she, like, you know, people could only watch my video at like 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. That was it. You know, she was a real piece of work. I'd like to just tell her, you ruined my career, you old bitch. You know, like, you really did. Like, seriously. Right. And is the world better because you all were there? No.
Right.
In fact, no.
In fact, you helped sell more albums thanks to your stickers.
Exactly. That's right.
Craziness.
Was there anything that he ever tried to push on you that you're like, no, that's not happening? And again, we're talking about Prince, obviously. No, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, some of the really, you know, I know a lot of people were like, oh, you should have done those. You know, there were some other songs I was supposed to do on the album. Like, what was that? Some Kind of Girl. What was it? I'm a Lucky Girl or Insecure Girl. It was something that I think Susanna sang it. We all sang it. And yeah,
Jealous Girl?
Those, all of them, they just didn't work for me. They were too poppy, and it meant that I had to contain my vocals a lot more. Like, I had to be with pop music, you have to be so precise, no variation, no flavor on anything. That's what makes pop music work, right? And you know, that's why I do have to give him credit when he did get his hit records, because that's a lot of restraint when you're singing pop and you can make it be like really exciting too. I didn't have that gift to do that. I was like, you know, just didn't work. I thought they sounded goofy and, you know, silly songs, but silly songs, like he said, you know, when you're writing songs, you write like it's for 4 or 5 year old, 6 year old. That's it. He said that quote him. Yeah.
But I guess what's interesting to me is like, you know, even though you were willing to say no in some of those situations, you know, there's songs.
Oh,
like,
misunderstood. You know,
that's
understood. Yeah. I'm just a girl who wants your love. Like, I was like,
yeah. That's on the bonus. I think there's a bonus CD of this that actually has that tagged onto the end.
Too saccharine. It wasn't even like, okay, if you're gonna like try to like, we're gonna come for Madonna, we need to come for Madonna, like, but not with that. That is not gonna get us there. This is like, we sound like we just, you know, no way. It was just not it at all.
Yeah, well, you take the moan and groaning from Lady Cab Driver and
right, misunderstood, right?
That's what I was gonna say too, is just like, you know, I find it a little humorous that, you know, there were some things you were willing to say no to, but other things like, you know, like Lady Cab Driver or G-Spot and Vibrator. I'm just like, that's
yeah, those were fun. Those were theater.
Takes a lot of, you know, and I'm not going to make you retell those stories. I think all the interviews you've talked about those. But I just think that I just think it takes a lot to be able to kind of go into that mode in a recording studio with the engineer just sitting there, just kind of, you know, watching you or whatever. It's just like, how do you even remove yourself from this? Like, okay, I know.
It's so funny. When I was younger, as I mentioned, I'd gone to school in Beverly Hills. So we had a pretty good theater department and I started doing a lot of plays. And there was one play that a friend of mine, Tina Landau, she, I guess, has something to do with Steppenwolf Theater now. She's done plays. She's a wonderful writer. She wrote a play. And it was called Faces on the Wall. And all of us did this play, all the kids, Pat Cassidy was in it. We were all Gina Gershon. We were all in this play together. And it was a musical. And yet it was sort of like the Me Nobody Knows. It was just kind of like a very cool. And we got to do it professionally here in the city. Somebody saw it. And then we did it for like a couple of weekends through the summer before everybody left and went off to college. So that was like, so for me, theater, having even a little bit of tiny foot in the door on that. I love theater. I love musicals. So, and you know, I think that's what it was like. Prince liked musicals too, by the way.
Yeah. He did. He tried.
He had a show too.
Yeah.
Nipsey Rose Lee.
Look at all the stage productions that he did in the Glam Slam studios and the Glam Slam clubs. He always tried to put on, you know, the plays, Homer's Odyssey or whatever it was.
He did,
And then he also was working with what's his name with for Deliverance. It wasn't Kevin.
Deliverance. Yeah.
Because that was supposed to be a man opera, whatever that was going to craft itself. It's like, dude, some ideas you just got to just keep in.
Yeah, there were some. Yeah, edit. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You need a little bit of a filter. But, I mean, it's not like you weren't like a fantastic actress. It's just like, you know, I think what's so amazing about this movie more than anything is that there was no well-known actors in this. It's like everybody was just like family. And Scotty Baldwin dropped this word on me last night, drops word on us. Minneapolitans, is that what he called?
Minneapolitans.
I was like, I've never heard Minneapolitans before.
Yeah.
That's new.
True. We were like the mini Neapolitans. It's true. Everyone was just a nobody basically. And it was great. I think it was because of it.
But everybody was fantastic. Everybody did a phenomenal job. It wasn't nothing. I mean, you know, when you look at it in perspective, I mean, some of it's kind of cringy, but I mean, for the most part, to be done the way that it was done.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It was
fantastic.
I think we, you know, kept to the timing. I mean, we pulled it off. He did pull it off. Yeah.
That's just, I mean, oh my gosh, it's just incredible. But so let's. I do have one question. This one's kind of like in the little bit of a, because you probably have insight to this that nobody's probably willing to share. So I know you're the right person to ask about this. All these individual acts as they kind of release their albums. Did you ever hear anything specifically about, you know, whether he liked or didn't like something, specifically stuff that he really didn't have any control of? As you notice, that is the theme among these albums. Maserati, there was only a couple songs that he was able to touch on that one. Jesse Johnson Review, nothing. Fruit at the Bottom, nothing. What was his really kind of feelings towards any artist?
He liked Maserati. He liked them. In fact, I was in the studio when I heard their thing, Strawberry Love or something. And then I literally walked out of the studio and went into the other studio and sang the backing vocals. It was like I was talking to Prince, and then I think Mark had come in and it was like, hey, can you do some BVs? I was like, yeah. He liked them, but because he knew he wasn't gonna, you know, he didn't give them Kiss. So, you know, he definitely was participating in those songs and really wanted them to do well, those guys. Yeah, he did like, what other song did I sing on? Got to Get Out My Own Way, doesn't it go to me?
Miles an Hour.
Yeah, sang on that one too. So yeah, I was right there. He loved that song. Yeah. Ba, 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 ba,
ba, ba, ba, ba. Yeah, wow. Yeah, it's just, I mean, I was always curious, you know, specifically with Jesse Johnson's Review, because that and Wendy and Lisa's Fruit at the Bottom, and those are classic albums.
Yeah.
They still stand the test of times and they're phenomenal. And I always wondered why, you know, in some cases, there has to be like a level of jealousy of just like, damn,
Oh, for Jesse, didn't he like, he heard that Shockadelica and then he went and wrote Shockadelica. Right. It's really true. It's, it really sucks because, you know, my friend, one of my very best friends who sang with me was with Jesse. They have a child together. So, yeah, it was like hearing about the antics between those two was like, oh, my God, just never ending.
Yeah, it's just unreal. But I mean, obviously, we love this. I actually found this advert as well. But I mean, I still have this album to this day, and it's like one of my favorites. Well, it's good, but I like your writing style when you're like specifically with two was phenomenal. Yes. I mean, there's certain albums that are just like, man, this is kind of almost a little bit better, because with this album, obviously which is your debut album, for those who are listening on the audio, if you're listening on iHeartRadio, if you're listening on Spotify, thank you for listening. I'm currently showing a cover of Jill Jones' debut album on Paisley Park, Jill Jones. But it had Prince's touch and hand all over it. And you could tell.
And Claire Fisher.
Yeah, and Claire Fisher. And I think. Yeah, there's quite a bit of strings in there. Yeah. But I do remember thinking to myself, you know, as your career progressed throughout the years and I started hearing some of the songs that did not have Prince's hand on them, it's like, I really kind of feel like that really kind of fits her vocal style a lot better. It's almost like now it almost seems like listening to this album, it's just like, it's still fantastic, but it almost feels like you had to force yourself into that part.
True. I mean, I think the record I sang was not with all of those strings. They came in later, and he had come into town in New York, and we were driving around the city listening to it. And he goes, would you like to have strings put on it? Because he had just finished Under the Cherry Moon, and he thought strings were the best thing since sliced bread, and he had used it on Girls and Boys. And you know, I said yes, but took off some of the pop stuff. But in hindsight, it probably wasn't the smartest thing to do. I don't think I was really thinking about my career, and I probably should have. I think that for me, writing different, talk about writing, like with Mia Bocca, we literally did write that together. I don't care what some other people say. Because we called restaurants in Minneapolis. So it was way back early in like 82. We were on break. So we were in the house and we were making phone calls from the Purple House. The writing like something like a Violet Blue thing, this is, and other musicians will know this. Sometimes you get a track from somebody and they'll say, what are your thoughts on this? What do you have? And so you're listening to a track. Track writing is very different than like with the two record. I literally had my guitar and that was where every song was born from the guitar. Piano beginnings are really different. Piano chords get a little different in the studio. And Prince was the type who could be in the studio and have the chords. And then he'd like chime into your head over, you know, Stevie Nicks only uses three or four chords. That's all she uses. It's like, okay, right. Okay. And, you know, but those kind of things impressed upon him. They stuck with him. And as he, you know, met more people along the way, I think he even tried that. He tried to do what he saw others doing. So I'm sure, like, if you look at the time frame when he met Joni Mitchell, I mean, similar things. But yeah, initiated songs on a guitar or a track. And if you sing a melody over a track and then no one's there to alter it in those days, now you can move it around. But in those days, it was to tape. It was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And they'd be cutting it in half. And, you know, because really, Baby, You're a Trip is even longer. We cut that. It's got an edit in it.
Wow.
That's, yeah.
That's
like a whole day of church. The song. I was like, I never went to churches like this. I was raised a Jehovah's Witness and a Catholic. We didn't ever do this. Like, oh my God. You know?
I don't really know a whole bunch of your story in regards to your parents. I know that, you know, your father was from Italy.
No, he wasn't. He was Italian and clearly a lot of Irish, a lot more Irish than he knew, because he's dead now. I can't go and tell him, like,
there you go.
No, I don't know what is wrong here. Something not to make a sense. Because of my brothers and I are like looking and going, do you have a lot of Irish in your chart? And my other one was like, yeah, like, yo. I'm like 75% Irish, because it hit my mom's side and my dad's and a little bit of Italian. And my brother, same thing. We were like, okay. I don't think it's so weird. The funniest thing about that is like, we had a, my brother and I are half brothers. There's another brother. There's three of us. And we sort of found each other after in the middle of all of this life. And each one, like this one grandmother that we had is from like Tennessee, Kentucky area. And she basically was saying, my mom made it up. It wasn't real. She's lying. She's trying to trap him. And she said the same thing about my brother's mom in Hawaii when they had moved there. And then after all of this, I was like, I think she confessed, protested too much, because if anybody messed around, it was her.
Mm. Wow. Oh my gosh.
I'm not so sure that he was even Italian anymore. I'll be really straight up. I mean, these little DNA things can really like,
I've got stories. Jeff can tell you. I unwrapped the whole entire story. And I mean, the short end of it is that I took a DNA test because my father was like Polish, was like totally Polish. Like his family was Polish and his family was Polish there. And they came over from Poland and blah, 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 blah. And I took a DNA test and there was no Polish. And I contacted my mother and I said, how Polish was dad?
I know, right?
And instead of a risk, and of course she gave me the whole, oh yeah, he was Polish, blah 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 blah. And instead, and I said, so I took a DNA test and there's no Polish. and instead of her response, you know, being, oh, those stupid DNA tests, she said, oh, no. And it ended up unraveling this whole thing, and I'm like, oh shit.
Oh my god.
It was insane. So these DNA tests, yeah, it totally unraveled my whole world. And I'm just like, oh my god. Now obviously my father was very, very similar to yours. He was just like not really involved, and I think the last time I saw him was five. But the fact that I believe that this person was my father for 50 years of my life.
That's crazy.
Like, wow, okay.
Isn't it funny though? I mean,
insane. But the reason why I asked was because I didn't know how your parents felt about you know, your career, you know, specifically in this range and in regards to Mia Boca.
Well, my dad was a musician. He played for Don Ho in Italy, because after in Hawaii, believe it or not. So,
oh my gosh.
Wow. He was a drummer, and like after my mom got pregnant, he like split town, went to Hawaii, like his family and everybody was like, you gotta go. So he left. They were kids. They were like, you know, 17 or 18. They were so young. So, so anyway, I had spoken with him over the years, got to know him, and apparently he was really like gobsmacked when I did all of this stuff, and he was proud. He'd show all of his friends about Purple Rain and everything. But one interesting thing happened when he had the chance to come and meet me, like, because we never met. It was on my terms. We were on the Triple Threat tour. We were in Cincinnati. He could come over. I was like willing to send a car for him. Prince was like, yeah, do it. But then like he didn't show, he didn't come. And Prince came to my hotel room, because I went back to the hotel room, and he was like, he knocked on the door and he was like, hey, you know, are you okay? And I was like, he knew he didn't show. So he didn't make a big deal. He goes, you know what? I think we're going to fly to LA on the, there were a couple days over. Let's just fly. My grandma had come or whatever. But after we left, we went to LA to record. It was like the holiday or something was going on. We yeah, it was nice of him. That was a nice moment because he knew I was really disappointed. And, you know, I think on the plane, he was like, you know, some people just can't, you know, this was my terms. Like, and that Prince reminded me, this was on your terms.
Right.
This wasn't his term. And he hadn't shown up for most of your life. So he wasn't going to be able to do it. Not with everybody here witnessing this and watching, and couldn't face it. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's just, and I think, you know, you're just full of, you know, verve, and you're very, very different from all of Prince's other proteges. And I think one of the biggest standouts is obviously is that you were just willing to just kind of walk away and be like, screw this. I'm just, you know, I'm capped out. I'm capped out on you. I'm out. Yes. And that's one of the things I, you know, I definitely appreciated. And obviously all the emotions and everything kind of, you know, led to some pretty awesome stuff.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, when you think
about, you know, this record was tough because I had lost, when I did this one, I was alone in the world. I just had my daughter, and I was just trying to function and come out of it. I had really shitty boyfriends around this time. Like, oh my God, I could tell stories of like just how fucking far down into hell I decided to go. It was like Persephone, or it was like I always had toyed around with the concept of Hades, and Persephone, I believe, was the mythology going all the way down to hell and who was going to come and rescue her. And so this was really wild because the only thing that would rescue me, Chris Bruce has always been one of my best friends, and he was always there, and he was in Chicago, and I just took a break and went and wrote this. And, you know, slowly my life started opening up, but I was in a lot of pain. And you know, I think Uncle Earl died somewhere around a couple of years after my mom. He had pancreatic cancer. It was really brutal. And I remembered I couldn't go to Minneapolis. I couldn't go. And I just said, I can't, because I couldn't take another person, you know? And, I was often very surprised that Prince never called after he died. He didn't offer condolence, nothing. So those were, we had some, in this lifetime, I don't think we were very nice to each other as time went on.
It was kind of, that's disappointing, because I know that in retrospect, during that final, those final 10 years of his life, he was actually going out of his way to kind of reach out to people and say, hey, sorry about that. Sorry, I messed you up and blah, 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 blah. But it's a shame that you were kind of left out of that mix.
Yeah. And then, you know, when you see him again, it's always like with a joke, or the onus starts to turn into where you have to brush things off. Like, I'm like, okay, let's just, it doesn't matter. Like, even after we saw each other, you know, at Vanity's thing, it was like, I think Apollonia had gone down on stage with Susan to introduce Susan to the crowd. I don't know what that was about, but anyway, you know, we're standing over on the balcony, and he goes, there they go. And I said, you know, you used to always call her a drunk, and you started those rumors. I said, you know, I said, why do you have to be so shitty, so shady? And he was just like, it's just funny, you know? And I was like, he goes, because he was like, they've been drinking. I was like, they haven't been drinking, you know? But he, if the wrong people heard him saying stuff,
right,
that's how things happen. He really had a really weird, wicked sense of humor. You know, it was like, oh my God, like, dude. Yep. But then we laughed about stuff and went on about our business. And that was just how we always were. We took the piss out of each other all the time.
Eric Leeds said the same thing to me. He was just like, you know, I know it was all this love for one another and all the stuff he says, but if I could tell you, if I told you some of the stuff that he said in my ear, you would shit your pants.
Right.
Okay. All right.
That's why it's always been so hard to decipher what he said to somebody, because some people hold so tight to, but he told me, and my I could always hear my mom, beware of pillow talk. But it was that's such a black mom. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, you're in a high, but you know what happened. And then you better beware of some pillow talk.
That's right. Completely. All right, let's have, let's have some fun. We're gonna because I've got a couple of fun things I want to do
real
quick, and then I want to talk about the London session. So, you know, to be respectful of your time, and again, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. This is
amazing. I've been wanting to do this. Everybody was saying, Joe, you have to do it. I was like, I'm trying, you know, I'm trying. We're, you know, yeah.
All right, so here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna show you a photo, and you gotta And a lot of times we see photos and it's like, that's pretty cool. And everybody kind of,
I love James.
They kind of have their own perspective about what's actually happening. And so I kind of want to help you, you know, decipher some of these photos, and we'll start.
I was thinking the other day how much I love Balderdash. Like, I was like, that was a weird game, but I really liked it. It was a weird game.
Why was it fun though?
I don't know, but just the words and the,
I've never played it. I've never played it. Yeah.
You should. It's fun.
All right. Let's take a look at this first picture, and I'll go ahead and apologize to the people who are listening on audio. On, you know, just, you're just gonna have to just watch the video at some point in time. But first, let's talk about this photo.
I know, right?
This obviously goes back, but kind of share a little bit about where this is at, what's going on.
Okay, that's a Norma Kamali sweater. I remember I bought those, and I had a Coach bag because that was my, you know, that's how I dressed then. I was my very straight lace. I'm with Kelly Minter, who was in the Freddy Krueger movies.
Oh, that's where I...
And Mask, yes.
Where I'm from. Yeah.
Okay. And she was dating Andre at the time. And Andre had introduced me to her, and we went to... this show, and I'm thinking it was the Civic in Santa Monica, but I can't, we can't place it. Me and Andre are like, where were we? It's not Flippers, because I was in a different outfit at Flippers. But Jamie Shoup is the blonde.
And there's Chick over there on the right. And
Chick, of course.
You Chick.
But yeah, so yeah, we drove down to the show, and I used to see Prince all the time when he would come into town, though. So when he'd be on tour or whatever. But this time I was with Andre, and Andre had already left the band. So it was, they were seeing each other again. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Some of these historical photos like this are just incredible. It's like the fact that this even made it out into the ether is amazing to me, because he found a way to bury these photos a lot of times.
He did. And I love how both of them had their hands in their pockets.
Yeah. That's true. Didn't even notice that. That's an insecure thing, isn't it? Isn't it like when you're just not comfortable in a situation or
something? We need body language experts on why they both chose, because really they hadn't. This was a show, I think, that we saw without Andre in it. Yeah.
No, that's just incredible. All right. I want to hear know about this.
Oh my God. It was at Stephen Campbell was with a radio station or something. And, you know, I don't know. Really, it was my.
A variety of photos of you in front of a jukebox for those audio only.
Right.
I think that was my Angel Heart phase, right? Like wearing thrift clothes and looking like I came from the bayou or something. I don't know.
Kind of hot.
Yeah. People always do those things where you have to take a picture. I was really tan though. I'm like, wow, I was really super tan.
You just went the whole Lisa Bonet route. Is that what you're doing?
Must have done, yeah. I used to wear a lot of thrift clothes, I think, as we all did back then.
Oh my God. All right, let's go.
Another hated thrift clothes. She hated the store. She's like, it smelled to her. She couldn't stand the way thrift stores smelled. I was like, oh my God. So of course I
smell. Now.
I love thrift stores.
I love them. Me too.
I just look at this. I think that's a northern thing. It's just like, you know, gotta go.
Totally.
Yard sales, garage sales, thrift stores.
Well, I also think, you know, black, the era of my mom growing up. She didn't like old houses and she didn't like old clothes. And no, not in a family of six kids. She was the youngest. She got all their clothes. So for her, old used shit, as she said, was not going to be her thing. No. Yeah.
All right. And I actually had it written down what photos were next. And I have written on this bullet, no idea.
Oh, it was Karl Lagerfeld.
Yes. So.
Yes.
So our this is interesting. I got to get the story on this one for sure.
So Carl made this dress for me. My friend, I had some friends in Paris, and of course, Azadina Laya made all of my clothes, but then Carl somehow got in the mix and made a dress, and that my friend had asked him to make. And so we met and we talked, and you know, that's Carl, just a witty, intelligent, he used to run Chanel. And he also had his Lagerfeld designs, but he was a fascinating person, just incredibly witty. He had a tongue on him that was like, oh, he could be acerbic, he could be like funny, but he was a good guy. He was. And he could be shady. He could throw you shade. If you showed up looking like hell, it was like, no. No. Carl left everything to his cat when he passed away.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that. Are you serious?
Yeah. Wow. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
You're the person who takes care of his cat.
I could see you doing that with just between your cat and Zuzu. I could see it.
Right. It's true. They would have had to argue over it. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to leave any of them, considering nothing that I did has ever been written down anywhere.
Wow.
Which wins again, you know, just a last laugh. Don't
we should all learn lessons from from what's happening. That's assuming that one didn't exist, or that
fortunately, I did this thing recently with AI, which is taking my voice and will be able to identify it. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that works out, because I was like, you know what? And that will find the tracks.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? Now that you say that, I never thought about the fact that somebody could recreate your voice and just make you say something that I know that they can do that, but never in like underneath the scope of like something serious, like a will or something like that.
Yeah. Never. It's so funny.
Oh my God.
Yes. It's so funny. I had been reading something with Grimes, the singer, and she actually trademarked her voice and did something where people can use her voice if they want to record. But you know, it's basically, so I went into it and said, so a lot of these things coming out, whatever the estate and all of this stuff is doing, I was like, you know what? I may not be here, but AI will certainly know my voice. It will know the ramifications of my voice. So unless they go and change mixes, we'll see. You know. Yeah,
that's terrifying. All right, next photo.
My surprise birthday party that I threw for myself. So
what?
Oh, wow.
Stop.
Surprise yourself.
I did. And I invited all my old friends from like high school, and it was really fun. And that was the night, I don't know which one Prince stayed. He didn't come, but John L. came. Prince did the ladder or the cross. It was one of those on that night. Yeah. But it was a party. I didn't expect Prince to come, but his dad came and had fun with, like, I think Anna was there, all the Gordy women, Anna, Gwen Fuqua. He found his little stride. It was really nice, you know.
That sounds like fun right out of the gate. Yeah. Anna and yourself and the Gordy girls.
Yeah, yes. Anna Gay was there. Anna would show up. Yeah, there were a lot of them. There, the house, we had a party over on Benedict Canyon. It was really, really nice. Sometimes when you were in settings like that, Prince wouldn't be very comfortable or acknowledge that part of my existence. It's like when we were on tour, I took them to the Boston House, which was where Hitsville and all of that stuff was, to tour and to look at the old Motown stuff. And, you know, it's like he gets uncomfortable and he'll leave, or he'll only do half of it, because there was a bowling alley in the Boston House in Detroit. You could bowl, there was a swimming pool, all this stuff. And Andre and everybody else was okay. Matt Fink and everything. But Prince had a hard time fitting in with your life. especially if it was something like this, like to be at like Barry's house. It, I don't know if he would have been able to handle it.
Yeah, it's gotta be. It's something that's stuck in my head since you said it was, you know, the greatest art comes from introverts. And he definitely fit that mold for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
What is the story of this photo? I don't know. It's like such a random photo.
I've never been sure if it was really even me.
That's what I said too. I was like, is this her? We're about to find out.
I'm not sure, but I do remember it could be, because I'll tell you why. I had a hairdresser. He was Shaka Khan's hairdresser at one point, and he bleached my hair. It was bleached so much. The twist that's going on right there is really my, I used to do that all the time with my hair. I'd always wear them like that. So that's the giveaway for me in this. But the hair, he put these extensions in, and they were like real white girl straight hair. And I remember like going, wow, I don't even look like myself. So that's the only thing. Like, I'm like, maybe that was when we were coming out, and it was out here too. And I think I just went to go and see him somewhere. Yeah.
And the only reason why I lean towards more that it probably was you is because that same look that you have on your face is the same look that you have when you're handing Apollonia that.
It is. It is. And I had done this thing.
Who the hell are you?
Well, I also went through this phase where I was bleaching my eyebrows off. So there's. Oh, yeah. And then I remember I had a party once at my house, and I had penciled them in. And then, because it didn't look good, and I'm pretty sure that's me just because of that. And then my friends, I was really drunk, and they had to like draw them on in the middle of the night, and I had like, it's really crazy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Every now and then I'll let my wife do my eyebrows, but I'm like, don't make me look like I'm interested.
Yeah. Don't make it look.
Don't make it look like it's like I'm like kind of like, huh?
Yes,
like, I'm real careful about how you know.
Absolutely.
Or like you're shocked all the time, huh?
I know.
There's trust happening here. All right, one last photo.
This, you know, Warner Brothers. It was at maybe that's Stephen Campbell too. For some reason, I think it was another one that I went with him and. Yeah, maybe it was it was definitely Warner Brothers.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's just amazing because you're so photogenic, and it's just, I mean,
Are funny pictures, you know. So far, he would have been like, you weren't really dressed up nice that day, and you didn't. He called me once in the middle of the night, like in Paris. He, can you come over? I was like, it's like 2-3 in the morning, whatever. I went. He's like, I don't know why you're, you know, what are you wearing? I was like, I was asleep. I'm sorry. I'm not like looking like I should be on the runway. Like, really, it was really contentious. I was like, dude, are you for real? Like, I just literally rolled out of bed. I don't think he had a concept that everybody, because first of all, this was before cell phones. So if you call me at home and I answer at 3, obviously I'm at home asleep. It wasn't like I ran into him at La Bandouche and went, oh, okay, I'll come over and, you know, hang out. I was just like, dude, I just threw on whatever was, you know. In fact, I think I threw on that little dress that was in the first picture, the Lisa Bonet looking dress with some police shoes. He was so upset.
I would have done it for me.
Right?
Because when you lived in Paris, you weren't. If you're taking the metro and stuff, nobody was like wearing like high heels. I wasn't. I had to like get around like a normal person. I didn't have a driver.
Wow.
You know.
All right. So the last little game we played, and then I want to talk about the London session, was just a couple of quick rumor cleanups. Mm-hmm. First rumor, you were Tina Marie's leg double.
Yeah, for Sucker for Your Love.
Oh, very cool. Okay. So in just the music video, did she not?
Yeah, just the music video. She did this really cool video for Sucker for Your Love. I think Nancy LaVisca, who's Red Foo's mom, told me recently that she was re-editing it. We were laughing because Tina didn't like her calves. So she asked me to be them. I don't know how it ever ultimately looked. I was I don't know, but yeah.
Okay, that's it. That's the usual. You were the original voice on Love Machine on Graffiti Bridge, and your voice was replaced by Elisa Fiorillo. That's true too?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. That's crazy.
Spite.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Is there this one? I think I already know the answer to this one, but we'll let you say it in public anyways. That Angie Stone used to be a backup singer for you.
She was. Yes, she was. I met Angie and fell in love with her, and she's one of my besties for a very good long time.
Is there any rumor that you continually hear people say about you that you want to clean up and just be like, okay, I'm done hearing this one. Stop saying it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've not been the best at times. I've spun out on people. I've, you know, very emotional, which is fine. But now I just don't really care anymore about, I think these interviews are setting the record straight. I think, I tried to do that in the Netflix stuff, which is, I guess, from what I hear, canceled, finito. So I've decided that, you know, in order to have my voice, I will speak on things and be completely 100%, because I think there's a cautionary tale in all of this. There's so many mixed things, like, and also looking at how the world has changed. I'm really shocked that it's changed as much as it has at 61. I never thought that it would have. You know, I thought, oh, okay, you did you? I mean, no. Honestly, have you guys, like, everything we knew is.
Right.
Was it like this for our parents and our grandparents?
Right. That's what I was kind of wondering, too, because, I mean, I don't think, you know, when I think about everybody that was presidents, you know, when we were kids and everything, mm-hmm. you know, it just all seemed, you know, yeah, there was. You know, tit for tat back and forth, you know, with Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan and all that. But I don't, there's nothing that is the equivalent of friggin' Trump. what even is level with the insanity that is this? I do not want to go politics, but that's what I'm
saying. I know.
It's that's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say, you know, I don't remember anything like this.
Yeah, no. that may be true, no. But I think it still is the same. I think it was the same, because if you look at the way the world is, your parents complained about what you were doing and what has happening, and now we're looking at things going, what's going on, and that will never change. The thing that's happened is, as a society and as people, we've become desensitized to what we're already experiencing. Right. So it takes more. That's why you have a Trump and a thing that people are tolerating, because forget that it's even a Trump, not a political thing, but when was there ever a time that somebody would speak up and yell at the president during a president's speech? You know what I mean? It's the desensitization that's, and the hate and the whatever else that is increased. And the world's going to continue to go that way. So I think it is still repeating. It's just we have something different to complain about, as the children and the grandchildren will, as it goes forward, until there's no more forward.
Yeah. From a parent standpoint, yeah, I definitely get that. Yeah.
I think it's lead pipes has fucked up everybody's brain. I think people are a mess. They're going to have to fix them. I heard them talking about it on the radio today, like, we're now going to start dealing with those damn lead pipes in everybody's town. Then I'm like, really? Like paint chips? And
I'm going to go back to eating paint chips. Yeah.
Why not? Because I just feel like, you know, I thought even with the music we were doing, all of this was progressing forward. Yeah, we were toying with, you know, gender and all these other things. But I mean, everybody's so freaking like,
It's too much for me.
Well, it's a lot.
I know everybody is kind of this, like, you need to be accepting of this, that, and the other. And I am. You do you, boo. But there's still, it's a lot.
My biggest thing is, it's not just the big changes of what they're trying to do, but someone lives their life the way they live their life. But to force me to accept something that I have to change how I see life. You know, like, do I have to, you are whatever gender you want to be, but mm-hmm. I have to call you something that I know, or I have to rewire myself, or why can't I just leave it alone and not care either way? Why do it's I have true. To say it differently? If I don't care, why do I have to treat it like I do, like it matters if it doesn't?
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to be misrepresented if I'm ever in like home and I hopefully I don't have dementia, but I start saying some out stuff to people from some old days and stuff. And they'll be like, I don't race this bitch. She's transphobic or whatever, only because I just have too much fucking information in here. I don't know what's going to crack, what's going to ooze out, or, you know, I just am like, oh my God, just like.
You definitely are going to be that crazy lady. I follow your Twitter account. You are definitely going to be
you are a future.
Oh my God, I know. It's just too much for me. I'm just like sitting here like, so when I look back on things and, you know, there's young people you're talking about how you were dealing with things, the music business or whatever. And people are like, oh, but you were traumatized and you were this. And I'm like, no, I was just living. And it's like, you guys now got me sitting here all up in my feelings. Like, I guess I am. I'm a fucking wreck. It's like, I had my bad moments. I had moments where I was so depressed. I thought about, you know, ending it all. I had moments with my head in a toilet, just like barfing my lungs up, whatever. I've been up and down and had a normal life like everybody else. But my God, it's like looking back and I'm like, well, I guess, you know, all I can say is it's been really shitty for women and that we were fighting and slogging it out all along. We walked around nearly naked. Now they want to throw us back in the kitchen. It's like, what the hell happened? That's the thing that got me shook the most.
Yeah, it's still derailed. Yeah, it's still
women. Derailed. And when did we become such a threat to everybody? And when did we as a society stop rooting for each other to win?
Right.
Everybody.
Right.
You know,
we're stuck in the me for me attitude.
I've been in that where I've piled on and said some really crazy stuff about people, but you know, that's the era part that I do like, that maybe we are starting to, but is it real? Because then there's this whole activism stuff. I've been toying with this concept, like, okay, you're an animal activist. You are this activist. You don't want this, but you are buying clothes where kids are making your clothes. You've got Botox where they've done all sorts of like testing on animals. It's like, if you really have to show people like all their true flaws here, it'll be like an episode of Black Mirror. And I think that's why people are unraveling, because you can't be who you're trying to be. You're not that. It's weird. This is some weird stuff going on.
Yeah, we never have enough information is the problem. We
think. Oh, my God.
We've got too much information now.
And sometimes I'm waking up and talking to my husband. It's like 6:30 or 7 in the morning. And I'm like, you know, I think that next time they put this election together, it's really, he's like laying there like, what the actual fuck is she talking about? It's so early. Like, are you kidding? Like, you know, I'm like going, yeah, well, like, and I'm continuing a conversation from the night before. Like, you know, like I just took a break for 8 hours.
You're a cat lady. That's it. I see. Yeah. You have the little cart from the shopping mall.
Yes, exactly. Oh, my God.
One of the things I am so happy to do a flashback on is the London sessions.
Yes. Hello. What are you here for?
Yeah, this is because, as I said, we can all reflect back on our life and everything that we've experienced. I've told my friends, I've said, I've lived multiple different lives. Like literally you could take portions of my life and be like, that was one person. This is another person. That was a totally different person. Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think everybody does typically leave. There's, if you don't, you haven't had a really adventurous life. And what's great about the London sessions is I listen to it even just with not the whole album. I don't have the whole album, but we have the few snippets that, you know, not snippets, but Unattainable Love, Red, and Some of Us. And It literally is like a time warp.
It really is.
It puts me in a headspace right out of the gate. It puts me in a headspace just like, oh my gosh, this is just like
Breakfast Club.
It is. Right. It's just so but freaking.
Can we go back there? Is the real question. How much can you go? I think it's
okay. I just focus on the positive parts of it, and that's what I really, really love. And I know that there's some pain and heartache, and a lot of the songs that are on there. And I know it probably for you specifically, it probably brings up dredges up a lot of different emotions and memories that maybe you probably want to forget. But on the same note, I think what's great about it is that I think everybody experiences levels of, you know, depression and levels of different emotions. And from what we're going to be able to tell, I mean, I kind of pulled the track list, which is 8 tracks. Mm-hmm. And it is the first song, Deep Kiss. That's a cover, isn't it?
It is a cover, Louise Goffin's song.
That's Carole King's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so you got 8 tracks, and for those who, when we release this interview, this album will be available to you. And again, you can go to funkatopia.com/Jill, and it will take you right to the Spotify account where you can actually hear the entire album by the time you hear this interview. But you got 8 tracks: Deep Kiss, Unattainable Love, which you can hear now. You can hear it when you hear it. Living Legend, Long Time, White Dogs, Some of Us, Red, and Tango.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are all fantastic songs, and I'm so glad that Neil was able to talk you into doing this album.
Yeah.
Because I know it kind of takes you back to some spots, as I just said, but on the same note, so many people wanted to hear this because there was always talk that this existed and everybody was like, well, where is it? And I think it was this perception that it had something to do with Prince and that the estate and whatever else was the reasoning for it not being released. And of course the truth of that was this had nothing to do with Prince. This was all you.
Yeah.
This was all you.
I mean, for me, it was like, I was kind of like left, you know, my house had burnt down. Everything was just sort of starting over. And in London was where I went. My dogs died in the fire, dogs that I had with Prince. I think that, you know, I was having to learn yet again how to do things on my own again. And so many new things had started to occupy his world, Prince's world. And, you know, I'm a very gentle person, even though I come across pretty rough and gruff. But that's, you know, like the Billy Goat's gruff. Like after I'm like really pissed, then I'm just not easy to get along with. But, you know, it'll come out. And then I make up very quickly. But, you know, for me, it was like it was a hard time being very disenfranchised and seeing other people come in and get to do the work, or I'm still going in and singing on people's songs and he's giving them away to other people. So it was still really difficult. So this other stuff, I moved away after, you know, having the fire burn my house down. It was kind of like a sign, a symbol of that it was time to, you know, get to stepping with my lemon pepper steppers.
But it's kind of hard to follow up with the question I was going to say. How do you follow that? Did he have a right of refusal on this? Did you like bring him to say, did you want this? And where? And so, because this was
recorded. He didn't understand me. He really couldn't, you know, he wasn't really good with emotion, real emotion that he couldn't pick apart and be very selective with. That was hard for him. So, you know, his delivery with a lot of his own songs, it was always wrapped and cloaked in some kind of fantasy. Yeah. It was easier for him to become a wordsmith or keep some kind of separation. He didn't understand the blood and guts of some performers, which there are many who, like Henry Rollins was a blood and guts performer that I actually enjoyed his stuff. And even though there were punk artists who were blood and guts, they were like, you know, it's all here. But straddling the line, like Deep Kiss is a little bit more formulaic songwriting. It's, you know, proper songwriters wrote it. These weren't. They were short. And then to pull him into it, you know, like 77 Bleecker Street, he and I wrote to, we worked on it after I had recorded it with Coke Johnson, like my engineer. And then Prince went in and reworked it. So we had started to establish things like that a little bit better. But he was having a hard time trying to figure out who I was, because I was also not around and I was leaving. And if I came in, he would have to find things for me to do to fly me back to Minneapolis to work on something or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I was growing up and I was changing and I had new friends and I had a new life, new everything.
I've heard a lot of stories. Like when we had Susan Rogers on the show, she said something very similar when he recorded Wally and said that when he recorded that song, she said it was the most beautiful thing that she had ever heard him sing as far as emotion, just laying his heart on the line. And she was just like, oh my gosh, this is going to be amazing. And he immediately came into the studio and was like, erase that one.
Yeah.
And then he re-recorded it and like everything that it was all gone. And so I get what you're saying. The point of that being, I get what you're saying is like, sometimes I think that he's almost too concerned about putting too much out there or being too open. Again, that kind of goes to that introverted thing, but you were like a master at that. You are like a master of putting yourself totally out there. When you're behind that mic, you're just like, it's like a switch goes off with you. It's just, and I think that's a lot of singers are like that. A lot of good singers are like that, where it's just like persona off stage. When you're on stage, it's like, I'm going to just, I'm in a totally different space.
I mean, I think when he did Something in the Water, he didn't do anything like that after that. Like that was quite a reveal. That was real pain. That was real hurt from his stuff.
So do I.
Yeah. But I also think that as time went on, he, as we all do, we learn how to get our shtick together with how we're dealing with our mastering of emotions. And you know, it's so weird because there's so much insecurity around the London sessions of being in a new place and working with new people. I wasn't used to none of the Prince people were there that I knew who were there to, you know, jump in. Chris Bruce wasn't there. These were just songs we had written. Mm-hmm. So they even have another origin, which was on like a 8-track that we had, which funny enough, lucky he had those because everything burned in the fire. So that was a really interesting time.
And you know? I'm so excited about this album. I'm so excited to hear it in its entirety. I'm happy for you viewers and also the people that are listening, because by the time you hear this, it will be available and you can listen to it right now. So I'm jealous of you. I'm jealous of you future people.
I mean, you hear like the range of like in White Dogs, there's, you know, there's timid moments where I'm in a studio and I've got these musicians from London who are like, this girl who's worked with Prince. So they're all like looking in, seeing me sing. So to really reveal some of that, Living Legend was sort of tongue in cheek. Like, I want to be a living legend. It was like I had a thing about, I really had, you know, met so many people who just took it all so seriously. And I guess now looking back, I guess you have to take it seriously. But could I live with something like that? I couldn't.
Yeah.
No. A lot of the most famous people I ever met, they're never like, it's such a, the ending is always so, you know, it's wonderful that they get there and they gave up so much to do it, is what I'm going to say. They gave up a lot that we maybe take for granted. And I just learned along, the more I kept pushing this music ball like Sisyphus. It was like, finally, it was like, what the actual fuck are you doing? You should have just gone to college and been a sociologist, you know?
Yeah, I could see you doing that.
Yeah.
When somebody listens to this album, what do you want them to walk away with?
Just how nice the lungs and the tone sounds. Like, there's some nice rangy things that, you know, the power that was there in my voice. And I want everybody to sit back and try to figure out why it didn't work with Prince and I. What was the disconnect? Wow. Where did we go? Like, we have the first record, but where did it, because he was so good with women who couldn't sing.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd heard all the stories about Apollonia, and there was a lot of frustration there during that period, specifically with Take Me With You. I'd heard that there was a lot of patience that had to kind of go into that. But, you know, and I've seen it online. A lot of people said, you know, he's worked with a lot of people, but you were certainly at the top of the game as far as like one of the talented vocalists that he took under his wing for sure.
I mean, and maybe there's something that we did. I mean, I think then as time went on, then he got into the more R&B singers who really, you know, that's never really been my style of singing. Like I just can't deal with a lot of stuff on certain records. It's not my thing, because I think it changes the heaviness of the songs. I like the Prince era where the songs were not too many tracks and thin, and even if there were a lot of tracks, you didn't know that there were, they were light and they just sort of were like a buoy in the ocean.
Yeah.
And his songs were like the buoy that you swim out to. I love that. That's just what I love the most, working on those tunes.
Oh my gosh. I cannot tell you how amazing it is that you are here in the studio. And I know we're over time.
I've enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Well, great. Thank you so much. And yeah, I mean, obviously, very, very happy for you that this is coming out, and hopefully it does get enough of a steamroller effect where it does warrant, you know, the capability, because I would love to hear this on vinyl. Oh my God. This would be, I mean, just
maybe. I'm sure that Neil is so, you know, he might, I think he has discussed it. So we'll talk about it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Well, let's make sure we talk about May. You have a May event.
That's right. That's right. I forgot. I forgot totally about that. Yeah. So we got to make sure we can't miss that. Did I even, I got to make sure that I included. I did actually include it. I had a bunch of things to talk about, because you also have, thank you, Jeff, for reminding me of this really cool event on May 26th that's happening with the 40th anniversary of Purple Rain. It's going to be Dr. Funkenberry is going to be there, but of course, Jill Jones, Andre Simone, and Jerome Benton, and special guests. We don't know who the special guests are. So you probably do, but
I know I don't.
Okay.
I thought I was the special guest.
You are the special guest.
You are.
What's more special than Jill Jones?
Right? You know, these are like the last one of these things that I'm going to be doing. I've gotten to the point where I'm really excited to do this with Jerome, particularly, and Andre, but I just don't want to do them anymore. You know, there's not much more.
There's only so many stories you can tell. It's like, I don't want to tell you something.
I mean, maybe in the 60th anniversary, I don't know. Yeah. Hello? Anybody out there?
Yes. Yeah, it's getting there. It's getting there. I do have a question, though. Again, so to wrap up this part, though, May 26th, it's going to be at footlongdevelopment.com for tickets to this Purple Rain 40th anniversary. It's going to be a screening of the movie, and of course, there's a panel, which again, it's going to be Jones, Andre Simone, and Jerome Benton, which is going to be very, very cool. But here's a question that I did have regarding this 40th anniversary, which I cannot believe it's been 40 years. It's just un-friggin' real. What would you expect? What are you hoping to see with this? It seems to me like there's already been enough purple revisions and versions of Purple Rain, enough as it is.
Right.
What are you hoping to see with this 40th release?
I don't know. I know last year I did something at the museum of the Oscars Museum. They had a new cut, not a new cut, a new something technology that sort of brightened it or did something to the release, you know, and it was really nice. So I'm hoping that it stays, you know, in the technology wise that people can see people and it's not too dark, or if they have to, you know, I don't know what I'm expecting anymore. I mean, I hope people keep an open mind. It was from a different era. I think the girl thrown into the garbage can is very similar to the grapefruit in the face, Cagney. You know, yeah. In fact, I'm sure it's like it's in that. And I think that in that era, who knew that it was going to become such a, you know, there were some things to have a sense of humor about, the campness of it. We're in a climate that doesn't have that at the moment is a little tricky too. I mean, I don't know. There were a lot of, like, how's the family? So this new generation, when they look at things, it's back to where I'm like, oh, I don't know. Like, you know, when people ask, you know, I'm glad they didn't put Wednesday in now because it was about suicide. I don't know. We'd have to have like a suicide for the hotline. And right. I don't know. It's like where people are so afraid of some of the topics that we were talking about. I don't know.
Afraid, but not afraid, because you look at the comedy that's out. Look at some of the comedy with like Anthony Jeselnik and Dave Chappelle.
Yes, that's true.
Some of the things that they're saying is just like, wow.
Yeah, that's true. So it's anybody's guess, right?
I don't know how some of these people don't.
Also, another thing is I always get this thing where a lot of people think I'm a white woman. I'm biracial. So it's always really funny. That's one thing that I'm like, even nowadays, I'm places and I'm, you know, talking with, if I'm with my cousin sometimes and I'm talking, you know, they have to come over and say, Jill, keep it down. Because they're going to think you're a white woman saying all this crazy shit up here in Ohio. And like, you know, I'm like, you know, like, it's really like, whoa. It's like, they're like, you know,
we don't need your help. We have our own level of crazy.
They start thinking like it's some white lady over there saying all this like blue, you know, stuff, talking about her cousins, you know. And don't let me throw around a few words like everybody else in my family. But yeah, no, I have to be like, I've discovered that it's better in those scenarios to let my hair be curly than it I get my woke hair and woke outfit. And then they're like, otherwise get like, otherwise you start thinking I'm Rachel Dolezal or something.
Oh my God, here we go.
I know, right? Can you believe that? I'm like, what? Because I'm like the most militant. It's always the real light skin one too, who's the most militant in the group. It's always been like that in my family.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree whatsoever. So also, before you guys leave, I have to be sure to head to the Urban Vacation. Put the scroll back up. The UrbanVacation.com is going to be some really, really cool stuff that's going to be available. Obviously, I've got this very awesome, awesome Jill Jones mug on there, but you might be some other surprises as well that you may find there. There's all kinds of things that you can do. You can take Jill Jones' logo on a bunch of different things. But head there. They got some awesome, awesome, awesome mugs, which is my favorite.
Found out that I can do, thank you for that, but I have this broadcast thing, channel thing on Instagram. And I'm going to talk about secrets on that. I'll release things that won't be, you know, out in the open. I'm going to start doing that, you know.
Oh, all right.
Calls on all things. Right. So they're going to be quick, fast, and a hurry sales.
follow, subscribe. You don't want to miss it. Let me tell you, when I follow your Twitter account, I was like, oh, I got to see what you're
doing. I closed it. I got rid of Elon and my relationship. It was terrible. oh my God, it just heated me up too much. You know, I can't do it. But I did open up another side one that I hardly go on, and I just look at things. There's not much to see anywhere. Everybody's crazy on that thing.
Yes, yeah, it is.
God, it's like lobotomy central.
Either. If you click on a tweet to kind of look to see, oh, I want some find some more information about this tweet. Now it's littered with things that don't have anything to do with the tweet that you just clicked on. It's like, why is there other stuff mixed in here?
That's so true.
Oh my God.
And then I had it where they could notify me about things. Then they were like, no, but did you see what happened over at the such and so? I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of driving and they just keep coming. I was like, nope, 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 nope.
Thank you so, so much, Jill, for coming on the show. It has been an absolute honor to have you. And
thank you.
I hope it will not be the last visit for sure. Thank you so, so much, Jill.
Thank you. Love you guys.
Love you guys.